The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
When you listen to the rhetoric of East Central European populists like Orban in Hungary or Kaczynski in Poland, one of the things you're hearing most often is the slogan, this is their favorite slogan, is we don't want to be copies, we want to be ourselves. When Ivan Krastev, who's my co-author, and I were listening to this, it occurred to us that there's a clue here to understanding why the process of democratization and liberalization produced a politics of grievance and resentment. And that's because once you see that democratization was a process of imitation, and then you realize that imitation often produces resentment for the simple reason that to want to imitate someone is to confess that they're better than you. And over time, this hierarchical relation between the superior model and the inferior imitator can be grating, can be humiliating, can make you feel like you've been dispossessed of your culture.
I'm Jacob Schultz, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 4th, 2020. Stephen Holmes is the Walter E. Meyer Professor of Law at New York University. With Ivan Krastev, he's the author of The Light That Failed, A Reckoning. Jack Goldsmith sat down with Holmes to talk about his new book and much more. The pair discussed the fate of liberalism in the decades following the fall of the Berlin Wall, Holmes's experience studying Eastern European politics, the problems with trying to export liberalism across the world, and the factors that have led to the global rise of illiberal leaders. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 530. Stephen Holmes on liberalism in the 21st century.
So, Stephen, I loved this book. It was an amazingly insightful and honest book, and especially as told by you. So why don't we start with the title, The Light That Failed, A Reckoning. Can you tell us what that means?
Well, the first novel of Rudyard Kipling was called The Light That Failed. So we sort of cribbed this title. For him, it was a book about his love affair that had failed in going blind. But for us, it was a play on the idea of the God that failed, of course, and the God that failed under communism. The communist God failed to the intellectuals who had believed in it. And this, The Light That Failed, seemed to be the offer of liberalism after communism to be a new God, a new hegemonic ideology, a new a way of organizing the political and economic world, which in particularly in Central and Eastern Europe after 1989 seemed to be celebrated as the future and as the beginning of a whole wave of triumph of liberalism after the end of its global enemy, the communist system. And it turns out, and that's the really origin of the book, we were trying to explain why the countries that in 1989 were viewed as the laboratories of liberal democracy and harbingers of the future have turned out, 25, 30 years later, into hotbeds of anti-liberalism, nativism, xenophobia, and authoritarianism. And so why did that happen? How did that happen? So the light that failed refers to the failure of the hopes of liberal democracy beginning in Central Europe, in the place where it seemed to be most promising.
Okay, so I want us to go back to 1989 to sort of try to create what the set of beliefs were that led to the foreign policies that you talk about in the book. So, and especially what your view was, you were the world's expert on anti-liberalism, I think it's fair to say, or one of them. When did you write your book on anti-liberalism?
It's early 1993, I think it was published. So I was.
Yeah. So it was a little after this. And you also had a center, I think you directed a center on constitutional law and Eastern Europe or Europe, something like that.
Yeah, and I was the editor of the East European Constitutional Review for about 10 years, from about then, 92 through 2000 and something early on, which was really a attempt to follow the development, but legal and political, social, of all of the post-communist countries, since this was an amazing, seemed like an amazing social experiment of how societies reconstructed themselves. It almost felt like we were, it had a kind of Darwinist feeling that you were looking at societies trying to become like the West. And so you, it made you ask about your own society, how did we get here? How did we become the way we are? When you watched these other countries trying to imitate our constitutions, imitate our electoral systems, imitate our stock markets and market systems and so forth. So it was a study of the Constitutional Review was really a cross-country, 15, 16 country analysis and survey that lasted those 10 years. It's still going on, and the Russian edition still exists. But also in the middle of this, I think that's another aspect, and maybe that's what you remember. In the mid-90s, I worked for the Soros Foundation, and I ran the Institute for Legal Reform in Budapest and worked on constitutional reform and legal reform throughout the post-Soviet space and Eastern Europe, including, that is, including the Soviet Union, Central Asia, the Balkans, the Baltics, and, of course, the Central and Eastern Europe as well.
So did you have, I don't know the answer to this question, did you have in the in 1989 and the early 90s, did you accept the Francis Fukuyama thesis, basically, and the idea that there was really just one best choice for how government should be organized?
I think, yes, in a way, I think we believed that this, and partly we believed it because we were talking to East Europeans. And when you went to Eastern Europe, you could see that they were so enthralled by the idea that escaping from Soviet domination meant becoming like us. And they, their way of this embrace, it was never, it was not, and that's very important to understand, there was not a kind of imperialistic imposition, particularly in Eastern Europe, of Western political and economic forms. It was enthusiastically embraced by the elite that we, of course, tended to meet, who often were Anglophone or German speaking. And they were very much, and even the Russians, even in the Soviet Union, there were many publications saying there's only one way, partly because when a whole system collapses like this, Jack, you have to say, what do we do now? And they were looking for something to hold on to. Their system had completely collapsed. What is the idiom they can speak in? What is, what are the institutions that they can try to build up? And you can criticize them, you can criticize the West, and I would do that as well. But partly it was such a radical change that you can't really blame them for like clinging, hanging on to something, this a fully, what they saw as a fully worked out model of a functioning society that would bring economic prosperity as well as some sense of human dignity. So they thought that's what they were doing. And we weren't really questioning this at the beginning. We didn't, there were, we didn't understand many of the consequences of this process. This we used the word transitology as the study of this process. It was only, you know, 10 years later that we started using the word traumatology, because we could see how much chaos had been wrought by the changes.
Yeah, so I want to get to the chaos, but just sticking on the kind of the founding of the post-Cold War sort of export or universalized Western liberalism. So you make a very important point that it was not imposed, it was invited. and it was welcomed at least by the elites. But that's not the way the rhetoric is now. The rhetoric now and the rhetoric soon became that the norms and institutions of Western liberalism and were something that were imposed. Is that fair?
Yeah, that is true. That's the way they talk about it.
How did that happen?
It's a violation of their national traditions of some kind.
How did we get from voluntary acceptance to them thinking it was something imposed on them?
Well, okay, so there are many aspects of that. One of the most important is, I think you can get at it if you understand the difference between 1945 and 1989. So in 1945, the losers against the Western liberal democracies was nationalism. Nationalism was defeated. In 1989, nationalism was a kind of silent, not always so silent, but more or less silent partner in the anti-communist reform alliance. Because, of course, for a place like Poland and Czech Republic and so on, all of these countries were embracing liberalism and Europeanization as a way of getting out from the Russian boot, the Russian power, out of the Russian empire. But they couldn't, at the very beginning, they didn't talk the language of nationalism at all. It was a repressed language because, remember, this was the time of Milosevic, and the bloody side of nationalism was on everybody's mind. And Milosevic, of course, was not only a bloody nationalist, but he was an ex-communist. So a man like Kaczynski couldn't use that language, nationalism. So he would talk the language of liberalism, but it was always somehow not quite honest in a way. So that's part of, this is just one aspect of the story, that there was already there at the beginning a way in which underneath the liberal talk, there was this kind of nationalist, you could call it a virus or power in any case.
And I want to get to how, when and how things started to fall apart for the kind of attempted absorption or implementation of Western structures, Western ideals, democratic ideals. Maybe we can focus on Hungary since that's one of the main examples in the book. And I just want to figure out, one of the things I don't understand is how much you tell mostly a descriptive story about how this happened and the mechanisms. And I want to talk about a lot of them because they're interesting, about the kind of rejection, ultimate rejection of these norms and the rise of anti-liberalism. But so just walk us through some of the mechanisms that led to the change.
Okay. So let me sort of, I can do this by reiterating or summarizing one of the main theses in the book, which is that when you listen to the rhetoric of East Central European populists like Orban in Hungary or Kaczynski in Poland, one of the things you're hearing most often is the slogan. This is their favorite slogan is, we don't want to be copies, we want to be ourselves. And this, when Ivan Krastev, who was my co-author, and I were listening to this, it occurred to us that there's a clue here to the rise, to understanding why the process of democratization and liberalization produced a politics of grievance and resentment. And that's because once you see that democratization was a process of imitation, which it was, and then you realize that imitation often produces resentment for the simple reason that to want to imitate someone is to confess that they're better than you. And over time, this hierarchical relation between the superior model and the inferior imitator can be grating, can be humiliating, can make you feel like you've been dispossessed of your culture. And so this, I think, is a key point, that the Fukuyama worldview, which you mentioned, was that a international system in which non-democratic societies with non-democratic pasts are imitating democracies will almost be a boring world. It will be a very conflict-free world, not a conflict-free, but a world that's basically uninteresting. And he was, and I think most of us were, not understanding the way in which relationships of superiority and inferiority can become, can produce feelings of resentment and anger. So, for example, and this was my experience quite often, I don't want to blame Westerners here, but I think you have to take into account how Western visitors were often seen by Easterners. They would come to Eastern Europe, Central Europe, a place like Hungary, the same way a tourist would go to visit the zoo. And what would they see? They would look and they would say, well, you know, they resemble us, these primates, but there's something they don't have. You know, they don't have an opposable thumb, or they don't have the rule of law or something. So there was a feeling of being judged. And this is, I think, psychologically, if you can get your, you see why. Ian, I watched this. I saw this happen in the 90s. At the very beginning, there was an embrace of Western advisors and so on. And then at a certain point, there was irritation at being looked down upon as a not a very good copy, as a botched copy, as a an inferior copy, which was almost maybe could sort of look like us, but never quite. So that's one, I think, a background point. Then to be more specific about Central Europe, and particularly Hungary is a very good example of this. The great Central European intellectuals outside of Hungary too, also Havel in the Czech Republic and Michnik in Poland, said what we want to be, and they said this in 89, we want to be normal. Communism was an experiment. We don't want any more experiments. And when they said we want to be normal, they didn't mean we want to be like Poland was before communism or the Czech Republic was before. No, they meant to be like the West. Be normal is like the West. To be like the West is to have no experiments. However, it takes you a second to think about this. You realize if you take a fully worked out model from the West and try to impose it in these societies, that's going to be an experiment, and it's going to have unintended consequences that can produce resentment. The most important example of that is this. If you take standard model privatization, Thatcherite privatization, and you try to implement it in a society with no private capital, like in Hungary, what's going to happen is that communist managers are going to take the resources of the enterprises and use that to privatize the wealth of the country. So you produce this, what happened, and this is what happened in Hungary, the wealth of the country went into the pockets of a few totally unjustly, totally without any kind of democratic process or any kind of legal formalities or and any kind of justice. So, and this, I want to focus on this for 1 second, because it really gets to the point of the, I think what should interest you about the failure of what was inadequate about the very language of liberalism for understanding this experience, and probably why we were blind to what was happening. So the language of liberalism, as you know, focuses mostly on individual rights. But if you privatize the public patrimony of a country, you're not violating anyone's individual rights. That the very language of individual rights, far from capturing the abuse, which is wild privatization, it almost blesses it. It sacralizes it by saying, well, these insiders who've have become multimillionaires are protecting their rights. So I think that's a very good example of how there's been an alienation from the liberal idea, because the experiences of the region were not adequately expressed or articulated in this language. And then let me give you one more, I think, very dramatic example. So in 1989, the main liberty that East Europeans, Central Europeans were promised and were offered, and which they in fact embraced, was the liberty to leave their country. They could cross the borders into the West. They hadn't been able to do that before. So this was the very idea. What is liberty? That's the main liberty, the liberty to leave your country. Today, you have these aging societies, very small, low birth rate, and you have an enormous outward immigration with an E, almost a demographic collapse. And many, many young people are leaving Hungary, even Poland too, but Romania had 3.5 million people leave since 2007, I think. Hungary, 1 million. All the young people, many of the young people, the talented people in these countries have gone to Western Europe. So that's a shock, and it feels like a kind of existential threat to the country, and it can't be understood if you use the language of liberalism of 1989. Which was the liberty to leave your country. So those, I think, are two good examples why the liberal ideal, although it has a lot to be said for it, we're going to talk about that, didn't fit the existential experience of these countries, and that's what gave opened the possibility for these anti-liberal demagogues to rally such public support.
Right. So let me talk about that. So Orban is someone. So I found your account of his rise to be grudgingly sympathetic, only in the sense, not in the sense that you admire his policies, but you did a good job of explaining why and how he came to power, and you made it even seem to me, if not predictable, understandable. Is that fair?
It is fair. I mean, I think, as you say, the book is primarily an explanatory exercise. We're trying to explain why this happens. Of course, you can denounce Orban or Trump, for example, but the question is, why did they arise? I mean, Trump came to America. It was a revelation because we hadn't seen all the things that were producing him. So our attempt is to say, why do so many people rally behind these populists? That's the question. It's an explanatory thing. It doesn't mean that there aren't, of course, there are ways to criticize. You know, Orban is a kleptocrat. He's very corrupt. He lies. He manipulates the system. All those things you can say. But he's obviously not popular because he's a kleptocrat. That isn't an explanation. So there's something. He's able to speak to some kind of anxieties in the society. He was able to, in a way that liberal forces were not. And it's one of the main, really, problems we're having today is that in these countries, in Eastern Europe particularly, the liberal forces are unable to win elections. It's not just that the populists are doing well, but the liberals are splintered. They can't get their act together. They don't know how to talk to the anxieties of the public. So it's an issue, and he did. And that's our problem. I mean, I love, you know, this is in the 18th century. Helvetius attacked Montesquieu. And he said that Montesquieu had, by trying to explain feudalism, he had justified it. So I think we need to distinguish. You can explain something. It doesn't mean you justify it. And definitely there are many faults with populism. It needs to be criticized. And there's a heroic struggle in Eastern Europe against populism, which is very admirable, not being that successful, but it is something I personally admire. And I think the question is to try to get a grip and not just dismiss it and say that can't happen, or how can anyone support this guy, which is the main reaction of Westerners. This seems like inconceivable someone who would have these beliefs that seem so archaic or seem to be returning to something that is a echo of a bygone fascist age. How could he be successful? So I think that to try to understand it, that was our project, our primary project.
And another element of that project was you were very critical, I thought, of the liberal project as it came to be executed. I mean, you, in one of the most arresting sentences in the book, and I'm paraphrasing, you basically said that liberalism abandoned pluralism for hegemony. You talked about the kind of take it or leave it attitude, the condescension, the kind of assumption that the Western liberal model was the only model and would just simply have to be absorbed. And what became voluntary requests kind of became, you know, rule from Brussels, rule from Washington. So how do you give us the account of liberalism's role in this.
Well, okay, so liberalism is an idea, and it's committed to a certain kind of economic order and a certain kind of political order. And it has many virtues, and it has a lot of resilience in it. And we wouldn't want to live in a world, for example, we may be going towards such a world in which political leaders could never be challenged and forced to explain why they're doing what they're doing. And one of the central ideas of liberalism is, of course, that everybody can be wrong, and power holders can be as wrong as anybody else, and they ought to be forced to explain their action. And if they don't, they're going to start behaving in a way that can't be justified. So you and I have had this conversation before. So I think that there's a lot of virtues of liberalism. But the problem was that after 89, what had been previously during the Cold War, a global conflict between two systems that tried to create replica regimes. So the Soviets created replica regimes all over the world, in China, including China, early on. And the US was trying to do that, most notably in Germany, for example. And when communism ended, the Americans sort of became complacent. They felt they stopped partly maybe because there's a certain parochialism in American culture in general. They stopped thinking about the many of the defects, the difficulties, the problems with our own system, which we have many of, and started trying, basically going around trying to sell this to others. The most, of course, egregious example of this that came later was 2003 and 2008, when America really, we really seemed to believe, or our leaders at the time seemed to believe, that we could impose a liberal democracy on Iraq after a six-week military campaign. It's a completely, totally different society. And I think one of the best examples of this is the belief by American officials at the time, leaders, legitimate leaders, had to be elected. Because, and we know this is a historical ignorance of the first order. Democracy is a tiny spot in human history. And there are legitimate leaders who are tribal sheikhs and who are religious leaders and so on, who are never elected, but they have perfect legitimacy. They just don't fit into our American idea of legitimacy. And if you go over to Iraq and you act as if we're only going to speak to elected leaders, you're going to have a hard time understanding the society, and you're going to make a lot of mistakes. And before you learn the mistakes, you're going to maybe destroy the country, which is what happened, I think. So there's a kind of blindness, presentism, self-absorption, belief that our system is the only system, not understanding the difficulty of imposing it in other places. I can give you a couple other examples of this, which I think are telling. In the early 90s in Albania, the American Bar Association realized that judges were being dismissed without cause. And this became, they were very upset about this, and they sent a team over to Tirana, and they helped them write a new constitutional regulation, which was actually passed by the parliament there, which said the judges cannot be dismissed except for high crimes and misdemeanors, of course, whatever the Albanian equivalent. After that, what happened was that they started putting judges in jail. So what does that story tell you? It says if you try to introduce a liberal formula in a society whose power relations you don't understand, it's not going to act the way you think. It's going to have a consequence you don't expect. Because, of course, these rules, which you can borrow, you can take, don't work the same way. It's a big mistake to conflate production technology with interaction technology. Or I can unplug a refrigerator in New York and plug it in maybe in Russia. Depends on the current, I guess. But I can't unplug our legal system and plug it in Russia, because there's a whole different, the expectations, the training, the relation between the judiciary and the procuracy are so different.
Yeah, but aren't these huge differences a problem for liberalism on the global stage? I mean, you just said that liberalism insisted on its way of doing things, and that's anti-pluralistic, and this is a typical paradox of liberalism in the domestic sphere, but it's really exacerbated in the international sphere. Rawls had a very difficult time extending his theory of justice, I thought, to the international stage. And I think there's an element of that that you're talking about. So it really raises the question, you know, what should a liberal order's attitude towards the variety of non-liberal orders be? And must we insist? Because our foreign policy seems to be premised for a long time on insisting that these other countries reflect our values. And so how is liberalism supposed to negotiate that problem?
Well, I mean, again, modesty is in order, realizing that our system is not the endpoint of all of human history, but it's the present state of a certain historical course of events that brought us to where we are, and others are going to be in a different place. It doesn't mean that certain values are not of something that we can be proud of and think about trying to promote. Elsewhere, but trying to impose them in this way, it reflects often, I think, Jack, what happens is that we tend to fall back on our own models and think they're the way everyone should be, the less we know about other countries. So if you take the difference between Afghanistan and Iraq, in Afghanistan, we had been, the CIA and we'd been in Afghanistan for decades. They're fighting the Soviets. We knew all the Americans knew all the warlords. They went into Afghanistan. They didn't wait to elect somebody to talk to them. They knew who to talk to. Iraq had been a kind of denied area. And so we sent people over there, very naive people, who didn't really, and who did, know a lot about the organization of Iraqi society. And so the, in the place of their ignorance, basically, they decided to try to create a system that resembled America. So that was a disaster. Now, I don't think liberalism commits you to believing everyone has to be liberal or like yourself. I think it should be a liberal democracy should be a self-critical system, which is aware of human fallibility, and it should think about keeping things balanced. Now, that's another point here I would want to make. This is, I think, an important response to your question. Again, 1945, what we exported to Germany was a kind of social compact liberalism with a strong welfare state, big public sector. It had a very important balance between the state and the market. Workers were brought into the boards of companies and so forth. 1989, liberalism had evolved. Our liberal democracy had evolved in a kind of Reagan, Thatcherite tradition, small reduced welfare state, the idea at least. And this way of thinking, this different kind of liberalism created its own problems. And that, I would say, is a very important part of the story. And you ask about Hungary, and I didn't really speak to that as you had asked me to, but Orban became a populist hero in Hungary because of 2008. And 2008, before 2008, I think most Central Europeans thought Western elites knew what they were doing. And after 2008, people realized they didn't. And yeah. It became clear that a bunch of gambling investment banks almost destroyed the world economy. The prestige of the model that was previously being imitated collapsed. So there was a sense that this liberal system in which the balance between state and market had been lost, and that deregulation became became almost a sacred idea. Someone like Balcerowicz in Poland was even more adamant about deregulation than anyone in the West. So there was a sense of this, and that this became this destruction, not destruction, but this kind of economic system, which was introduced in the name of liberty, but produced appalling kinds of inequalities. That's one of the main sources. And once it was seen to have had this major crisis in the West, that's what bolstered the capacity of populists like Orban to convince people that following the West, imitating the West, is just the wrong way to go.
Especially since, as you said earlier in the book, there were these challenges to national identity and the like. I mean, it was more than just, but you're saying that the economic collapse was really the precipitating event.
I would say it's a very important one. Yeah. I mean, you're right. There's another aspect of this, which is, of course, there are many aspects, but one is that for Hungary and Poland, democratization, liberalization meant joining the European Union. And the reform elites, who were liberals and who were most adamant about joining the European Union, accepted almost, I would say, almost without thinking, the norms of a post-national European Union, which was, of course, you know, almost in a way created for Germany, for Western Germany in particular, because Western Germany, having been traumatized by nationalism, was looking for salvation by being integrated into a post-national Europe. So the post-national ideology of European Union was very attractive to these reform elites, and they left on the floor of their societies national symbols, national traditions, and this was what allowed a counter-elite, a populist counter-elite, mostly of provincial origin, to pick up these national symbols and say, everything that's going wrong in our society is caused by the fact that these liberal elites, our own liberal elites, have forgotten the nation and have tried to, and have simply tried to integrate us into an international order in which our own national tradition means nothing.
Weren't they right about that?
Yeah, there's a lot to be said for it. And in addition, the European Union was telling these societies that they had to become democracies and said, you're making a progress, you're becoming a democracy. But by the way, all of your laws are going to be written by us.
Right.
So this created, that's a psychological, time bomb, really, to tell people that you're democratizing, but it doesn't matter. You can elect one guy, throw this leader out, put another leader in. All the laws are the same because we write them. So you're telling them that they're going to be a democracy, and you're telling them that they can't be. So that was also a part of a kind of humiliation of this process that produced a lot of course, resentment. And there are other factors here that I think are very interesting to look at carefully. One important one is that the process of imitation in post-communist societies was multi-speed. So I noticed in Russia in the 90s that journalists became westernized very fast. They were unbelievably, they were almost within a year, they were writing investigative journalism almost at the level of Western journalism, the best Western journalists. Now, the people who worked in the prosecutor's office, not so much. They were like stuck in there. And so you created tensions in these societies by rapidly trying to make them over in the Western models, because it didn't happen evenly. And another good example of the tensions that were produced is that in the book, we describe the difference between two kinds of normality. So there's a normal meaning what you should do, and normal meaning what everybody does. So you have typical cases in a place like Bulgaria, for example, where a politician knows that he has to conform to Western norms, and he has to set up a commission against bribery, because bribery is wrong. It's not normal. It's not the norm. On the other hand, he has to live in Bulgaria, so he gives bribes and he takes bribes. So it creates a kind of this almost schizophrenia of a political elite that's living in two worlds. And that's a very unsatisfying and disconcerting place to live. Yeah. And that also, I think, led and has been part of what has fueled a attempt simply to detach themselves from these Western norms, saying, no, let's go back just to be ourselves. We're not going to try to organize our lives according to these foreign principles.
Yeah, I thought that some of the most insightful parts of this very insightful book were the analyses of the various psychological impacts on the people in these former Soviet countries or Central European countries of normalcy, of the copycat mentality, of the kind of arrogant attitude of insisting on democracy but not allowing them to choose their laws. It seems in retrospect, from my perspective now, it seems like it would be obviously a self-defeating strategy. And I just don't understand what the theory was, the theory of the West, the theory of Brussels, the theory of Washington. Why wasn't this foreseeably self-defeating?
I think self-love is the answer. You know, people, I had many, when I was working for Soros, I had many lawyers who had been were discontent with their careers. I don't know, there was one guy who had spent 10 years defending a dioxin dumper, and he came to my office and he said, I would like my life to be more meaningful. Can't I, work on legal reform in post-communist societies? And so I said, well, that sounds good. What do you want to do? He said, I want to teach them to be just like us. So this was a kind of, it's like asexual reproduction or something. People are trying to, like mirror imaging, programming others to be like themselves. It's a kind of idiotic, of course, impulse of human beings, I guess. But I don't think it's excusable. And I think the lack of understanding of the misfit, the lack of knowledge about the societies, of course, played a big role in this. Also the lack of historical understanding about the difficulties of coming to be where we are today. This is not, liberal democracy isn't something that popped out of a toaster like toast. It doesn't just pop out automatically once you get rid of the preconditions. In fact, that's a good way, I think, to explain this. We thought there was a mistake. People thought the absence of obstacles, if you get rid of the tyrant, is the same as the presence of preconditions. So people thought you get rid of the communist regime, and so then what's going to happen is something very natural, which is you're going to be like us. So that's very naive. I wasn't quite that naive, but I think I was swept up by the by the desire of particularly of the liberal elites in post-communist societies, who, of course, were very eager. They had been cut off from the world. And so they were unbelievably wonderful conversationalists because they had had their conversations bottled up for decades. They were enthusiastic about this idea. And they thought, how are we going to remake our societies? And this was the one model they saw. So we didn't reflect. And we didn't, of course, also reflect on how we would change, which is another thing we didn't see. You know, our society was, all America was organized around, in good part, around anti-communism. So it's pretty natural that at the, when communism is over, our society is going to change, and this ideological centerpiece of our society is going to become weaker. And of course, we noticed that after 9/11, because in the Cold War, human rights was obviously a ideology that was helpful in distinguishing ourselves from the Soviet communism. But in the War on Terror, human rights soon became seen often as a kind of Trojan horse for those who want to do us harm. So there would be, these are like, you can see that values and values around which we organize our social life change over time. And we changed radically. And of course, then the West, the anti-communist West, which East Europeans wanted to join, by 10 years later, just wasn't there anymore.
So let's, we don't have time to do full justice to your chapter on post-Soviet Union. Can you talk about kind of analogous to the economic collapse in 2008 and the impact on the desirability of the American model? I think you argue that the war in Iraq and, you know, indifference to international law in general was another blow to the attractiveness of the American model. And you also talk about, and this is what I want you to explain if you can, how Putin came to use our tactics against us.
Yeah. So we have this idea of, I mean, there's defensive imitation, there's aggressive imitation. Putin is a very good example of what we describe as aggressive imitation. And I we use in the book, and I think that's helpful for our listeners, a non-Russian example to introduce the theme, which is that ISIS, when it was about to execute its victims, its captives, would dress them in orange jumpsuits. Now, this was an act of symbolic imitation of what the U.S. did in Guantanamo. And it was a signal and an attempt to send a message, which was a message that, look, you Americans claim you're defending human rights. You Americans claim that you're such, you're so virtuous, but actually, you violate these rules as much as anyone, and we're going to do to you what you did to us. So that idea of we're going to do to you what you did to us, we believe, is essential for understanding Putin's foreign policy. Putin is not a great strategic genius, although he's, you know, relatively done a lot with very little. But he is obsessed with proving that Americans are hypocrites, and he's obsessed with doing to us what we did to him. So there are many examples of this. The one that we all know, he thinks the Americans interfered in Russian elections, and he's very set on his, the desire to interfere in American elections really came from a belief that we had done it to him.
But we had done it in 96, and it's unclear whether we did in 2011, yeah, exactly. Right?
It's not that we did it so much as he thinks we did it.
No, in 96 we did, though. It's pretty clear we did but not in 2010, 2011. He believed it. I'm not sure if it's true.
Correct. You're correct. Absolutely. I think you're probably not true, but in any case, this is what he believed. In, if you read his speech in the annexation of Crimea, and why he is justified in amputating Ukraine and taking Crimea out of Ukraine, he was, it's almost word for word, a copy of American speeches about Kosovo. I mean, he's like deliberately imitating. It's a human rights question. It's self-determination. It's autonomy and so forth. So he's very conscious in using a American rhetoric in order to challenge Americans and to try to take cut them down to size and show them that all of their pretense to superiority is a bunch of baloney. And I think the thrill at showing that American democracy is so fragile and so confused and so easy to interfere with is another victory for him, because what he had experienced, what the Russians experienced, was, you know, 30 years, 20 years at least, of Americans looking down their nose at the Russians and saying, you know, you're not a democracy, you're so inferior, look at us, we have these great freedoms, and you don't. So I don't think this is a an amazingly brilliant strategy for really bringing Russia back to the status of a superpower. Not at all. That's not happening and won't happen. But it reflects his sense of grievance at the humiliation that the Russians, Moscow, suffered in 1989-91, when their empire overnight collapsed, and basically the West won the Cold War. And his policies have been an attempt to try to somehow, it's very vengeful. It's a vengeful policy. Stick your finger in America's eye, show that Americans can't do things, reveal the hypocrisy of Americans, more than really trying to put Russia in a position where it can actually get up off its knees, which it hasn't done.
But that's kind of typical of the resentment that you think.
Yes, it's a politics common. Of resentment.
Yeah,
it's a
exactly.
politics of resentment, not a politics of nation building.
Right.
You know, there are 60,000 fewer kilometers of road in Russia today than when Putin took power. He hasn't developed the country. What he's done is figured out a way to stick his finger in America's eye, as if that were, you know, people say sovereign democracy, which is like telling the West to get lost or something like that. That's not a form of government. That's just a kind of revenge against America.
Yeah.
And you kind of give, and this is what I think gives the book an amazing coherence, you kind of give the same account for the rise of Trump. And I would say of what you say of Trump, I think is what you said of Orban was true of Trump. You're clearly not at all sympathetic or admiring, but you do give an account of why he happened that's consonant with what happened elsewhere.
Yeah. The most amazing thing about Trump in this context is that he's managed to do something which, first of all, no American president has ever spoken this way. And that's why I think he is really an original character who reflects some new phase in American society. But what he's managed to do is to convince the people who support him that America is the greatest loser from the Americanization of the world. You know, up to this time, the institutions that we built after World War II, NATO, of course, the European Union, which we were definitely behind, the liberal international order, which in my IV, I think the best way to think about it is the core of the liberal international order was, one way to put it is preventing the nuclear Japan and Germany from becoming nuclear powers, or to put it more positively, channeling the nationalism of Germany and Japan away from militarism and into industrial productivity, which means copying us, really imitating our export-led industrial economies and becoming economic superpowers by doing this. So this was, I think, the core idea. It was thought by the organizers of the post-war settlement that that would be better than World War III and certainly better than the threat of nuclear war. This was exactly the settlement that Trump, from the 80s, expressed against which he expressed the greatest resentment. Because you remember, he said, we beat the Germans, we beat the Japanese, and now they're selling cars on our streets. And this is terrible. Why? I thought the winner should to collect the spoils. Why are Germany and Japan beating us in creating luxury cars and so forth? So Trump saw imitation of America as a wound in some way, as somehow a loss, as opposed to the way I think most of us would see it, which is that's much better than the alternative. But he didn't see it that way.
But can I jump in on that? Because
because
I think you say this, I just want to push back just a bit. You know, I'm not sure we saw it that way or most people saw it that way. The remarkable thing about Trump, he tied this not just into neoliberalism and the terrible distributional consequences within the United States of neoliberalism. He also attacked, although he didn't follow through in office, global militarism, which he said we were basically assuming the costs for this order and not getting the benefits. He tied immigration concerns to that. And the amazing thing was that he found a huge audience for it that, as you point out, elites in both parties had missed altogether.
Yeah. No, I mean, one of the keys to the Trump success is that the difficulties, again, here's the difficulty of liberalism. The liberals have a hard time really fighting him with all of their might because he says certain things that we all agree with. So I would like divide as well, the things you just mentioned. I would distinguish between protectionism, which is a saying that many of our workers have been harmed by aspects of globalization, particularly the export of middle-class status from US and Europe to India and China. That's true protectionism. Non-interventionism, which is a very big liberal cause, of course, but also nativism. So nativism is something liberals don't share. This kind of xenophobic nativism, the racist element, you know, the way in which the wall is a kind of just a form of birtherism in steel slats or something, a way of saying that there are certain people who don't belong to us, they're inner enemies, there are those who aren't really Americans, all of that, that's quite illiberal. But the non-interventionism and the sense that that American workers can suffer from global trade, unregulated global trade, I think those are things which are true. And if I suggest Googling, which I've done a few times, the phrase, "But Trump is right about."
But it's more complicated than that, I think. And I think there's a more blame to go around than just others than liberals. I mean, it was Bill Clinton who, you know, did Kosovo and embraced neoliberalism in the most robust way. You know, Barack Obama came to office pledging to pull back, and he did in terms of heavy footprint, but he expanded the light footprint war and went to war in Libya, which he later regretted. I think it's more of a, I don't think liberals, at least liberals in government, have actually, I think that Trump attacked them successfully on both the trade and distributional consequences of trade grounds and the aggressive militarism grounds.
And let me add to that. Remember, both Clinton and Obama were, and I think we're hearing that also, I heard it in the debate last night too, said that every American should go to college. Now this is, it sounds like a good-hearted, it sounds like a generous statement, but every American is not gonna go to college. And that statement, that claim, implies in a way that if you don't go to college, we're kind of giving up on you. That's very alienating. And Trump definitely spoke to that. He talked to people. He said, if you don't go to college, you still have dignity. If you're not part of this, this is a sense that there's an educated elite to which you don't belong to, and they look down on you. And liberals have a tendency to embrace this. And I would say this is where I think we can usefully use the expression universalism is the particularism of the educated. And it explains, I think, a lot of the populist resentment against the New York Times, New York elites, Hollywood, and so forth. All of us, you and me, and all of the educated people, we like to be around people like us. I like to be around people who read Lawfare, who see the same movies I see, who read the same books. I have a kind of, you know, there's a commonality that has nothing to do with your passport, your skin color, your ethnicity, your religion. It's about education. But it's a desire for homogeneity. It's a desire to be around people like ourselves. We then look at other people who are less educated. They tend to cluster in different ways along different lines, not by education, but by whatever their ethnic group is, let's say, or their certain kind of neighborhood. And we say about them, I don't know if we call them deplorables or say that they're clinging to God and guns and so forth, but we are saying that they are somehow racists, or that they don't like to be around people who aren't like them. But that to many people seems very unfair and self-delusional almost. So this sense that there's an educated elite looking down on you that doesn't really understand your environment, that tries to impose its way of living on you, who doesn't see why it doesn't apply. I think all of that is a domestic version of what we were talking about internationally.
Yeah.
And Trump definitely appeals to that.
So the remarkable thing about your book is the extent to which you are a member of the liberal elite, but you really do engage sympathetically that critique and use it to explain the rise of anti-liberalism globally. I want to wrap up by talking about the future. You open the book pessimistically. The first sentence is, "The future was better yesterday." And the last sentence of the first paragraph is, "Most of us now have trouble imagining a future, even in the West, that remains securely democratic and liberal." And then you have a book that I have to say was fairly devastating and pessimistic for how liberalism, Western liberalism, has performed in the last, since 1989. But you close on a somewhat, I think you try to be upbeat in the end. You talk about Kipling's book having The Light That Failed, having two endings. And you talk briefly about a world of pluralism. Can you tell me what is the basis for optimism here? or hope?
So I have a very close Hungarian friend who I once asked him if he was a cultural pessimist. And he said, no, in Eastern Europe, nothing works, not even pessimism. So I think that's a part of this, is that, you know, pessimism can also be just an attitude which makes you feel very safe, too. So I would say two things. One is that every order has its own characteristic disorders. And that's definitely true with liberalism, but it's also true with populism. And populism is going to produce its own discontents. So I don't think that we should assume that the defeat of liberalism, temporary defeat of liberalism, or the fact that liberalism is besieged and is back on its heels and has lost its sense of self-confidence, doesn't mean that the opposite, that illiberal politics is going to be so successful. I think that would be the wrong conclusion. And liberalism, our idea is that liberalism lost its self-critical capacities. It fell in love with itself. It believed very foolishly that it could be hegemonic in the world, and that this lack of self-criticism, lack of modesty about its capacities, the lack of modesty about its relevance to every social setting, I think is was debilitating. But it doesn't mean that liberalism has nothing to offer. So I think the main thing I've thought of is that our perception of the threat environment has changed very radically in the last few weeks. But the relevance of the pandemic to our themes is very ambivalent. So on the one hand, you could say that anti-globalization sentiments are going to be increased by these fears.
I mean, before you go on to the other hand, Orban has already said that the virus is caused by foreigners.
Yeah, Trump also used the word foreign. So yeah. On the one hand, anti-globalization sentiments. On the other hand, we need scientists all over the world to be cooperating on this, for sure. On the one hand, we're going to be falling back on our nation state because health systems are national. They're not international, the hospital systems. On the other hand, when our hospitals start collapsing like they are doing in Italy already, people are going to feel betrayed by their nation. So that's mm-hmm. a difference. So I think also there's a identity politics, which is part of the populist business. It's at the beginning, there's going to be xenophobia, as you said, like blame the Chinese or something. But in the end, you're going to be just as threatened by your identity group, members of your identity group, as anyone else. So the danger is not associated with the other identity group. I think it's such a challenge to the way we organize societies. It's a challenge also to the idea that we can return, for example, to something pre-liberal, such as our kinship group. Because one of the things you've noticed is that the intergenerational cooperation where grandparents take care of their grandchildren doesn't work anymore. So this is a kind of, it has put pressure on all the most basic forms of sociality. And my question really, the question I would leave you with is whether or not this populist idea that truths, even if they're true, can be dismissed because they're partisan tools, which I think is a very strong populist belief. Even if what you say is true, you're only saying it to hurt me, so I'm not going to listen to it. Mm-hmm. That's that idea, which is very prevalent in our current political atmosphere. Can that survive this crisis in which you would think that knowledge is one of the few things that can protect us? Or is the pandemic going to increase the level of irrationality in the society so that any kind of commitment to scientific rational argumentation is also lost even further than today?
That's a great question. We'll find out soon enough, and I hope it's a good story and not a bad story. Stephen Holmes, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Jack.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Stephen Holmes for coming on the show. Your producer was Jen Patiahau, and music was performed by Sophia Yan. Please rate and review the Lawfare Podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and remember to share us on Twitter. And as always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.